So we now have time for questions. We have two roaming mics on either side. So if you can please sort of raise your arm to indicate that you want to ask a question, and perhaps also briefly say who you are. And what I like to do ideally is I like to group sort of a couple of questions and then have people on the panel respond as they feel like. There's a question there. We start here in the front. Thank you.
Professor Manning, you stated, I believe, that the federal regulation in America does not really amount to very much as far as the industry is concerned. Did I understand that correctly?
Yes, I'd be happy to elaborate on that. I don't think people behind you could hear your question, though.
Oh. You don't need to switch it on. It's permanently on.
It is permanently, okay, now it's on. Okay, yeah. I'll start again. About the situation in the USA and regulating or controlling or influencing the debt industry. First of all, one wonders about proposals to control, and the ones you showed were at federal level, essentially, in the recent years, but you state those are rather ineffective, rather toothless. What about organizations set up to control people in distress situations? What about consumer organizations in America? What do they exert influence in this sector, try to exert influence? Finally, what is the fraud experience? I suppose fraud with these generous margins is something that is sort of built in and is, doesn't pose all that degree of threat.
Let's add, there was another question just across the aisle.
I have a rather simple question, I suspect. I paid my mortgage off some time ago, no doubt rashly, and so I now have some savings, and so I receive interest on that, and presumably people who are poorer than me are paying me. Is it the case that the whole system makes the rich richer and the poor poorer?
Okay.
I'm trying to. I wanted to show my chart on deregulation. Let me just say, in general, what's happened in the United States. Consumer groups have power at the local level, typically, unless we get into the institutional exchange between contesting legislation. So consumers historically have had more influence at the city level and at the state level. What's happened with the deregulation of financial services is now we've seen nationally chartered banks essentially absorb and merge the state chartered banks. So what we see now is overwhelmingly banking institutions that were regulated by states where consumer groups had more influence now are owned by national banks. And under, it's called federal preemption, which is based on the Commerce Clause of the U.S. Constitution, nationally chartered banks can only be regulated by the U.S. Congress. So that's what's happened. That's shift the regulatory emphasis now in financial services away from state level to federal level, which therefore means that you have to introduce and pass a law of Congress. It's also significant because with deregulation, there's the emergence now of hybrid institutions that offer financial services. For example, Walmart, which is, of course, going to be the largest corporate entity in the world, has been dying to figure out how to become and take advantage of all this money through financial services. They recently helped win an antitrust suit over the use of debit cards versus credit cards. And for them, the merchant fee that they pay is billions and billions of dollars. And because of federal regulation that says an entity like Walmart cannot own a bank for fear the bank would be loaning money to Walmart. They've been denied access of owning a bank because they want to have their own credit card. So they've opened up credit cards, but basically they're only getting a little bit of the money that's made. Instead, what they're doing is they're doing looking at where there are openings. So they've found out that they can offer things like certified checks. They're looking for ways that they can finance within Walmart. They're trying to come up with enough bundles of financial services that they can create an institutional entity that is not a real bank and therefore doesn't come under regular federal regulations. And so what's the real troubling point now is you see these things emerging where you can cash a check and you can borrow money through a payday loan, and nobody really knows who's responsible for regulating them. Do state usury laws apply to these non-chartered banking financial service entities that are charging 800% interest? And that's become the debate in, you know, in terms of asking whether consumers are, the elasticity of demand for financial service products is reflected in what they'll pay for interest rates. Well, the fact is that we're talking about the fastest growth of financial services in the United States is this second tier, where the average annual percentage interest rate is over 250%. So clearly, elasticity for people who are in difficult circumstances really doesn't matter. They'll pay whatever it takes. So the issue in terms of fraud is really pretty interesting, because the best example I can give you is that if you want to apply for a credit card from a major banking institution in the United States, you can apply 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and you'll always get a person to process your card. If, however, you want to call about fraud on your credit card on Saturday evening, you'll probably get a message telling you to call back early on Monday or to leave a message about what your credit card identification is, and they'll hold it. The point is that it's so profitable that there's far less concern of the industry to follow up on fraud other than their global policies, as well as to go to a bankruptcy hearing and contest whether that consumer should be forced to repay their debt. It's just so much cheaper to let them go through the system and to start all over again. But to the industry's credit, they've done pretty good with fraud, but you probably haven't heard much about the Patriot Act from the United States, which is supposedly regulating the flow of international flow of finances. Turns out that most terrorist cell activities in the United States are financed through the fraudulent use of consumer credit cards. That there is an incredible scam that you can take cash advances on and maximize the amount of credit that you take and falsifying consumer IDs that the U.S. government really hasn't effectively crack down on, because the amount of money from the industry's perspective, $30,000, $40,000, when you're talking about trillions of dollars of charges, just isn't worth it at their effort. And that's really one of the interesting things. I've been talking to a person who's writing a book on this and why the industry and the government isn't responding effectively. So, in fact, the banks actually opposed the Patriot Act in the United States because they didn't want to have to explain why and where people are borrowing and using their money. So fraud is actually on the decline in terms of percentage of discharges. In terms of the issue of financing and the cost for poor people versus investors, well, I think the point I was trying to make is that with credit cards, in the old period where everyone basically paid the same amount of money, buy 1,000 pounds worth of furniture, you paid 5% and you paid it off. Percentage has gone up. But they need to show that if you stay out of debt, there's a reward to it. You actually get free money. And so that's a tension that they're actually working on through some other issues of membership fees and things like that. Should we be concerned that we're making money off poor people? Obviously, that's the way of financing capitalism. I'd be more concerned that people, if you feel that the risk of someone is so poor that you're going to charge them 800% interest, I feel that federal regulation should come in and at least make it manageable where those people can repay their loans. I'm far less concerned about whether people are going to make a lot of money on buying these kinds of asset-backed securities.
Perhaps Anna or Razia want to come in on the issue of fraud or these repayments.
On the issue of what? I just wanted to mention that, again, I don't deny that some of these issues are important, and they are, I completely agree they are important, and the need for regulation is probably there. Once again, I find it very hard to work on this and think about these issues without hard evidence. Now, it's very easy, it's very tempting to work on anecdotes. And there is a big risk of basing your prescriptions and stuff on anecdotes, because the anecdotes, they go on to make a good dinner party conversation are the funny ones, are the one that strike our attention. Now, I don't deny that you can learn a lot out of this, but, you know, nobody's gonna tell you anecdotes about people behaving in a normal way. And what I need to know is how prevalent these issues are, and this can only be based on, you know, very extensive surveys and very hard facts. Now, this is hard work, but this work that fortunately is being done. I think one of the things that we have learned a lot is how to measure things. The other thing that I learned to be very skeptical about is about what people know about the literacy and stuff. And if you ask at the end of a 2 hours interview a question to somebody, this chances are that this person just want to get you out of his way or her way and give you whatever answer can give you to make the interview finish. So it's extremely difficult to elicit the sort of information that we need. But fortunately, progress is being made in that field.
Well, I'd have to at least say in the United States that those are not the trends. Financial literacy of probably the major study of high school seniors shows that not only is it appallingly low, but it's actually gotten worse. Also, the fact that 10% of all American households have declared bankruptcy in the last 10 years, I think shows us the magnitude of not only the level of indebtedness, but the fact that the market system, in terms of regulating lending beyond the debt capacity of households to repay, is not functioning the way it used to. The other point is about survey research, and as a survey research methodologist, this is an issue that's very important to me. And one of the things that I find, especially among economists, is that they want everything summarized in very neat and concrete ways. Asking people about their debt is like asking somebody if they're overweight. They're not going to overestimate how much they owe, and generally they're in denial if they do. And to actually get somebody to open up their personal finance books to an outsider and to explain things, number one, they probably don't know. I mean, when we do surveys, and I've done thousands of interviews, most people don't know what their interest rate is. And the easy credit regime is, I want 5,000 pounds, not that I want 5,000 pounds at 8% rather than 9%. And so when we start looking at things like surveys, I constantly hear, we got to get the survey under 35 minutes. Well, most people I've interviewed takes 35 minutes for them to trust me, to tell me not what I want to hear, but what they're willing to share with me. So that the extant data, survey data in the United States is very poor and vastly underestimates the debt issue. And at the same time, as the financial services industry has become very creative of filling more demand because traditional debt measures have, the bells are ringing. I'll give you an example. The fastest growth of driving a new car is through a lease rather than buying it. And typically it's because people can't qualify for a loan. Well, the way the U.S. government measures debt, a lease is not a debt. So if you compare somebody who owns a car or buys a car versus someone who leases it, the person who leases it actually has less debt. well, we know that doesn't make any sense. That household would actually look less distressed than more distressed. Things like payday loans and pawn shop loans, they're not counted as debt. The government doesn't even ask those kinds of questions. And I don't think it's an accident, because given the relationships I have with the Federal Reserve in the United States that measures these kinds of issues, and the fact that the banking industry doesn't want to be accused of lending money to people they know can't repay it, what we see is a situation where if the consumer is driving the economy, we've got to make it clear that the debt capacity hasn't been reached. If we underestimate the level of debt, the engine of growth is still on the track. And that's my concern and future cautionary note.
Can I just say, I think it's really important that we differentiate between people who are in debt, which is, for many people, a way of life and a way of managing their finances and not necessarily a problem, and people who are over-indebted. And I think in the I mean, certainly in the UK, the data on over-indebtedness indicates that we have a very important but relatively small group of people who are experiencing serious over-indebtedness. What we then have the purport is a large number of people who are using who are using credit and have debts in order to live their lives, whether that's mortgage debt or credit card debt, and there, I mean, that's the, it seems to me that that's a portion of the population that we in order to make sort of generalizations about, we need to understand rather better. And amongst that large population, it's quite clear that there are a very significant group of people who are managing their debt and are going to be able to finance it even in the event that circumstances change. But there is also a large number of people, and it's a question about how big this group is, who have overestimated their ability to deal with changes in the economic climate, who will get into over-indebtedness problems if things substantially change, and who don't understand that. And it seems to me that's the group of people, which certainly in the UK, I mean, I don't know what the state of the sort of the information is in the States, but in the UK, that's the group of people we need to understand better, because that's the group of people who are going to be potentially at risk if environmental circumstances change, which they're almost inevitably, yeah, they almost inevitably will within the next few years. So that seems to be the gap, I think.
Can I add just one thing to this?
One thing, then I want to bring in some more questions.
Because I hate to give numbers and opinions that I don't know completely, because I spend most of my day checking my numbers. But if you force me, push me on guessing these numbers in the U.S., which is about which I know a little bit. The numbers that Anna were referring to, I think the sector of the population for which this is a serious problem, this mis-selling of credit, this over-indebtedness, all this, well, my guess is like 10, 15, maximum 20%. And then there is the bulk of the population for which credit is incredibly useful, and probably should be more of it, because debt is not bad per se. Debt is a good thing, because if today I'm unemployed and I know that I'm going to get a job, I want to be able to borrow to finance my consumption and my welfare and my well-being. And there's nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with it. The one thing that I'm taken aback in your approach is this undercurrent that consumption and debt is bad per se. I think the problem is, and there are serious problems there, is with this mis-selling, and it's probably affecting a relatively small proportion of the population. Now, how big it is, there is more work to be done on that. Why does this happen? There is more work to be done on that. Is regulation necessary? It probably is. Are financial literacy programs important? Bet you are. I mean, there is the evidence on the effect that 401ks have on stimulating savings and the prudent behavior towards retirement saving. 401k is one of the tax advantages schemes in the U.S. that are extremely popular. Some evidence shows that the effect of 401ks is not through the financial incentives, it's not through the effects on tax deferral, etc. But it's through education that some of the schemes provide to people. They teach them about, you know, interest and about savings and prudent behavior. So I bet you are, but I bet they are important, these schemes. But this maybe not such a huge problem as you painted.
I will give Robert a chance to come back to that. But some people have been very patient. So I first the woman here towards the front in the black sweater, and then Ben Fine in the back. And I've been keeping track of other questions as well. So I have your. I've seen those who are in line.
I'm Hannah Gregg from the HRB Centre for the Study of Domestic Interior. And I was actually interested in the advertising strategies that you were presenting during the course of the lecture. And I was particularly struck by the way in which the credit card seems to be used as a type of membership card that communicates particular messages about status and personality and identity. But that made me think a little bit about how the credit card seems to be used more on a day-to-day basis, perhaps for supermarket shopping or for everyday purchases. In that case, the person that you're actually showing the card to is a complete stranger, and it's a very momentary and fleeting sort of presentation of membership. So I was wondering really why then the credit card continues to have that sort of design aspect where it continues to convey or seek to convey messages about identity when we're in that increasingly sort of anonymous setting. And then that also struck me that later in the lecture you raised the new MasterCard advertising strategy, which kind of portrays the credit card as a way to facilitate a personal relationship, that if you can buy the cinema ticket, then you can get close to your girlfriend. So that seems to be a new sort of communicating message that's been applied to the credit card, that it's a way of facilitating a very personal relationship rather than belonging to a social group. So I was wondering if you could reflect a bit on that shift.
Thank you. And then there was Professor Ben Fine.
I want to say how much I enjoyed your talk and how appropriate I think your emphasis is on how consumer credit industry thrives upon and encourages economic illiteracy that the other commentators have suggested. But I want to change tack slightly and in a sense support you against the comments that have been made, which is to suggest that even if the rise of consumer credit consumer credit is important, even if this illiteracy were entirely absent. Because for your commentators, it seems as if this illiteracy were absent, then this rise of consumer credit would not matter because there would be this smoothing or this good indebtedness and so on. But even if it were absent, the fact that so much consumption is now financed through credit means that consumer credit system feeds into and fuels the financial system as a whole. And this is something which you referred to only in passing, really. And of course, what stands out is the extent to which the financial system as a whole has grown so speculatively and dysfunctionally, I would say, over the last 30 years. So it is correct to point out the way in which the consumer credit industry exploits its customers, but that is only, I think, the tip of an iceberg, and the body of the iceberg has to be assessed in relationship to the functioning of the financial system as a whole.
Thank you. Do you want to start, Bob?
Okay. First point I wanted to make that is a half of all bankruptcies in America are attributed to the inability to pay medical bills. And the second one is unemployment, and the third one being a personal crisis like a divorce. The point being is that what's happened in the U.S. experience is that as people have become reliant on credit, it's not a problem unless an extraordinary, unanticipated event occurs. And given the nature of marshalling consumption as part of membership in the society, the assumption is those problems will happen to someone else. And that's what I find extraordinary is that as the welfare state in America has contracted, new vulnerabilities have emerged. And it's that kind of disconnect and time lag that people have been trying to figure out, well, how do you survive? And if they're not encouraged to save, the only recourse is to utilize credit at whatever terms are available. And that leads to the other point that I wanted to get to at a little bit moment, is that we measure debt, but we don't measure the cost of debt. And being $5,000 in debt at a mortgage that's tax deductible that in real terms is 3% may not be nearly as bad as if you have a fraction of that debt that's a payday loan that you're paying 600% interest on. None of that kind of stuff actually is recorded at the governmental level to actually analyze. But let me go back to the other question. I think you've just made a really striking commentary about the nature of life in the United States, about the nature of fleeting and momentary relationships, that indeed for most people, given both the atomization of society and the fact that there's so much geographic change, you know, the assumption was when Ronald Reagan became president during the recession in 82 is that all those unemployed steel workers in Pittsburgh in the old manufacturing belt, they just need to move where the jobs are. And, you know, forget all of those other social attachments to family and community and things like that. So we kind of have a little bit of both. So on the one hand, it is striking. There are advertisements now where you choose on television what you want people to know about you in that 30 seconds that you're going to flash that card, because that may be the only thing that they're going to know about you. So at the one time you can become unique and an individual, and then before that person needs to get to know more about you, you can withdraw back to anonymity. And I think that's really what's interesting about consumer credit is, on the one hand, it moderates what we hope it would do, ideally, because I'm not actually a person who thinks credit cards are dark. I think it's the most extraordinary technological advance of the last 30 years. I'm more interested in people understanding and becoming informed about its most effective use at the personal level. And that consumer credit cards then have enabled people to have access socially and economically into spheres of society they may not have been prepared for. What sociologists talk about is social anomy. For example, in my research on college students, I find that first-generation college students and minority students, their very first semester, have an extraordinarily difficult adjustment period. And the ability to become one through membership of access to consumer credit and being able to buy all the new clothes, have the most modern and up-to-date and trendy CDs, gives these students an opportunity to fit in a way they didn't before. But on the other hand, they don't have the money to pay it off, and their parents can't help them, and they're far more likely to drop out of school because of consumer debt. So both symbolically, credit cards have, in a sense, leveled the status hierarchy field, because now a student in college who's never had a job in their life can demonstrate membership with an elite credit card, to the point that I opened my book with President Clinton being rejected on his American Express card for $60 purchase in a bookstore. That what does it say about this rationalized and impersonal system that we know the President of the United States can pay $60 for books, and yet the technological system rejected him because he hadn't signed his new membership card. Yet a college student who's never had a job, if they flash that same credit card, we don't think twice as long as it's processed. So there's a lot of these things going on that credit cards both at one level are helping to mediate differences and on the other hand give people an opportunity to demonstrate why they're unique. And I think the end of that story is yet to be written. The other thing is, since I'm in so many of these debates in terms of political regulation of the industry, it's always easy to create a straw man or woman and decide how to attack that position. And I try to take the more moderate position that consumers need to know when they've borrowed too much money, and banks need to know if they loan money to people who they know won't be able to repay it, that they should be held accountable too, and that means a higher loss on their riskiest and most marginal loans. It's extraordinary to me, again, during the recession, less than 5% of Americans were delinquent on their credit cards. So if we want to use that as an objective empirical measure, then it's not that bad a problem. But what's unique about the United States is that you can declare bankruptcy and you can liquidate your unsecured debts and start all over again. And that's that degree of generosity that reflects the profitability of the industry, that it's okay to lose that amount of money and start people all over again, and you're going to make the money back by charging them a higher interest rate. It's that incredible profusion of credit and the fact that people are getting it before they've had a job, before they've demonstrated any financial literacy skills, that they understand what the consequences are if they've wrecked their credit. And the number one reason in the United States that relationships fall apart at a social, personal level is over finances. That's the number one reason marriages break up. So there's obviously some important issues here. We're not measuring them as well as we should be. But I think the key is people are getting credit who never would have qualified before, and are they prepared to handle that responsibility? And my answer is, for most people, no, because they are not told what the consequences are. They might think twice about borrowing more money they can afford at 17 years old if they knew there were some negative consequences. So the big key for me is there's more money made in lending money to people than it is to manufacturing a product and marketing it. And that shouldn't be a surprise then that the credit, that the financial service industry has been extraordinarily creative in satisfying the needs that it itself has helped to create at a very high interest rate.
There's time to have two more questions here, but we will have a reception afterwards, so feel free to walk up to the panelists there. There was a question from the two I have on my list. Are from John there, and then the lady in the orange sweater across.
Thank you. I very much enjoyed the arguments about whether there's
Hold it to you.
Very so. Is that what last stand up and shout? I very much enjoyed the debate, and I want to return to the question of regulation. Because it seems to me that everybody on the panel, as it were, might have an interest in regulation, even if they don't think all indebtedness is bad. So even if we admit that there may be some bad debtors or bad debt, the question of regulation comes up. And I want to return to it, though, in the question, in the light of the advertising. In particular, the light of the advertising in which credit cards promise freedom, and freedom from parental rule, and freedom from paternalism. Because it seems to me that the question about regulation then becomes, whose freedoms we collectively might be willing to interfere with. And I am relatively sure that as soon as we begin to interfere with the freedoms of corporations, they will tell us that we are interfering with the freedom of individuals to consume as freely and as wisely as they might wish. And that might be a small political problem.
Thank you. And then, lady over there.
Can I just speak? I sort of personally, I'm not an expert in finance, but I don't really see this the relationship between cards and a well-ordered mortgage or savings account. A true Muslim, a believing Muslim, is not allowed to take any interest. Could we learn anything from them, or have you done any studies? I see you've got some worldwide banks there on your list, but I don't know if that is all the sort of Western type of bank, or have you done any studies on how could we? Could a president be elected if he got rid of credit cards?
I want to give Robert Manning and also the two commentators a sort of chance to have some concluding remarks. So, Bob, why don't you start?
Well, I'm going to be able to answer that question easy. In 1978, President Jimmy Carter actually put restrictions on credit cards, and it was one of the most woeful decisions he ever made in his failed presidency. That was certainly one of the final nails in his coffin. Muslims certainly do not charge interest, but that doesn't imply that there aren't creative ways of creating service fees that are associated with it, but certainly strict Muslims don't, and that's an issue in the United States where you have informal lending situations so that things like buying a mortgage, you can't go to a bank to buy a mortgage, and that implies then a whole set of niche financial service opportunities that will be available down the line. I think just to briefly answer the regulation question, what's extraordinary is consumers in the most recent legislation that I was involved with, the Fair Credit Reporting Act reauthorization last year, more people were concerned about personal privacy
rights, which nobody, I was really surprised nobody asked about that. The fact that Homeland Security is based on supercomputers that basically slice and dice every transaction, whether it's a cell phone call, whether it's a credit card purchase, et cetera, that was far more important in the legislation than whether credit card companies charge too high an interest rate. So that really, I think, says a lot about where credit cards are going, to the point that I actually hear a movement of people that refuse to use credit cards because they don't want their personal private information to be traded with other people that they may not want to know. That really came out with the hearings of appointing a Supreme Court judge, Thomas, who was approved, because he had used some credit cards to borrow some pornographic videos, and they didn't want that information to come to light in his confirmation hearings. So it shows you now a completely different aspect of use of consumer credit that in some areas is far more important than its economic issues. So right now, if we clamp down on consumer credit, world economy would slump, politicians would be defeated, households wouldn't have gifts for the holidays, we'd all be clamoring for the good old days of being heavily in debt. And that may not be as bad as some people think, but I think the real question is, who's making those ultimate decisions? One of the reasons I think the U.S. is having difficulty coping with a recession is that the old days, the Federal Reserve chairman could help make important decisions such as rate cuts. Now when he does, banks don't necessarily pass those rate cuts on to consumers, and the private interests of those banks now supersede the national interest in terms of stimulating economic growth. So that's my final comment.
No, okay. Anna?
Two things, really. Just one to pick up on Ben's point about financial capability. But financial capability, if it were hugely enhanced, would in theory, ensure that quite a few of the people who are currently using in debt did not even manage debt, did not enter into those kind of contracts because they would understand the risks. The fact is we're absolutely not in that place. The point of having some understanding of who is most at risk from their currently managed debt is in order to focus our public policy effort. And I'm simply contending that our public policy effort, in terms of its focus on consumers, should be particularly looking at those people who are currently over-indebted and those people who are at risk of becoming over-indebted because they've entered into contracts which they are not going to be able to sustain because they've not understood such things as interest rate risk. So that's the reason for raising that point, is about where we put our effort. A word on regulation. Well, I mean, regulation is absolutely about managing a marketplace, and that's what we do when we regulate. We are managing that marketplace to a greater extent than we were before, because there is some fundamental market failure in that marketplace about the balance of power between the players, in particular between the firms and the consumers, and we've made a decision that we have to redress that imbalance through the application of rules with penalties, and that's what regulation is. And whenever you regulate, it's absolutely true that firms don't like it because it is an impingement on their freedoms. Though there is this very interesting conundrum, because firms don't like regulation, but if you have a regulation, what firms want are lots of very detailed rules which give them the confidence that they are going to be able to interpret the rule and behave in the have all their competitors treated in the same way. So what they want is a nice little row of neat boxes that they can tick, which make it clear to them that they're sitting within the regulation and all their competitors are going to be treated in the same way. The challenge, it seems to me, in this environment is to arrive at an understanding of what sort of behaviour we think it is appropriate and fair for firms to enter into in relation to financial services in general, and in particular in relation to credit. And how do we expect firms to manage that code of behaviour, if you like? What are the responsibilities of the most senior management in financial service companies to ensure that all the way through their organisations, their consumers are being treated in a fair and appropriate way? And the fact is, that's not a concept that most financial service firms at the moment deal with. And I think it is absolutely the way that regulators regulation of financial services firms has to go. And that means looking at principles of regulation and fair behaviour rather than detailed rules. And actually, ironically, that's what firms will like less, is working to the principle rather than the rule.
Before moving on to the reception, let me remind you that the next public event will be on Friday, the 20th of February, on children and their parents and consumption. And we're very lucky to have Karen Ekström, the director of the Center for Consumer Science in Sweden, speak. And we'll be joined by Mary McLeod, the chief executive of the National Family and Parenting Institute, as well as by Dr. Chris Pohl, who is a sociologist in the program. But before going over there, let me take this opportunity to thank again Robert Manning for his wonderful lecture, and Anna Bradley and Orazio Atanasio for their very thoughtful comments, and you for discussion. Thank you.